yesterday.
I'd like to call to order the today's meeting, the House Committee on Judiciary Policy and Finance, come to order. Committee Legislative Assistant, call the roll, please.
Chairman Smith?
Here.
Vice Chair Szymanski?
Here.
Representative Johnson?
Here.
Representative Anderson?
Here.
Representative Champion?
Here.
Representative Cornish? Representative Gruenhagen?
Here.
Representative Hillstrom?
Here.
Representative Creasel?
Here.
Representative Lane is excused. Representative Lesh?
Yeah.
Representative Liebling? Representative Mazerol?
Here.
Representative Moline?
Here.
Representative Schumacher?
Here.
Representative Vogel?
Present.
Representative Wardlow?
Present.
Chair notes that we do have a quorum, so we'll proceed to our agenda. First being the consideration of the minutes from March 10, 2011. They're in the packet. May I have a motion? Representative Wardlow moves. Approval of the minutes for March 10, 2011. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes of March 10 are approved. Committee, we have space reserved after 4:30 if we do not get through this morning's agenda. And I will point out that it's the chair's intent to move the bill that we will hear first. The rest will be presented and laid over. So if that helps, good. Chair would like to now bring forward House File 998 by Representative Detmer. Chair moves House File 998 that it be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. Representative Detmer, go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman Smith and committee members. And I do have an amendment that I'd like to, Chairman Smith, if you would move. The A110129 amendment.
To get the bill in the order that the author wants, the chair moves the A11 amendment. Any discussion? If not, those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The bill as amended is now before us. Representative Detmer, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this bill basically makes it very clear in plain language that we do not produce copies of humans by cloning. And it makes it doubly clear that we won't be producing human clones for the purpose of research and destruction. This bill only applies, let me repeat, this bill only applies to cloning, human cloning. Language in subsection 5 is clarifying the language to make it very clear that we are only talking about human cloning and nothing more. This is an issue, it's a bipartisan issue. Banning human cloning does not put Minnesota behind. Rather, it puts it in the forefront with science and research, and which science and research is headed. Poll after poll shows that American people oppose human cloning. And for example, in 2010, a Gallup poll, 88% of people said human cloning was morally wrong. And the American people aren't the only ones that rejected human cloning. Even scientists are, for example, Rudolf Janisch, a leader in field of cloning, has just recently said in an interview in a magazine that the Scientist magazine, the human cloning is one of the not practical, not relevant. And in terms of other states, there's six other states that have followed suit with this type of legislation. A dozen countries have some type of cloning prohibition, including Canada, Germany, and France. And currently, Minnesota has a prohibition on human cloning funding that was passed in legislation in the past. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would open for any discussion or any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. Before we proceed to any questions, is there anyone in the audience wishing to be heard in support of this bill to offer testimony? Raise your hand. Is there anyone present that wishes to be heard in opposition to this bill to offer testimony? Raise your hand. I see none. Questions from the committee, if any, of the author? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Detmer, I'm looking at a letter here from the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. It says that it represents 8,000 members, physicians, scientists, researchers, and the like. And they're concerned that the bill's definition of human cloning includes somatic nuclear transfer, SCNT. No, I'm not a scientist, but apparently this is a major concern in the medical field that would criminalize not only reproductive cloning, which I think most of us agree is certainly that something that should be not allowed, but also SCNT, which is what I said is the somatic cell nuclear transfer used for scientific and medical research. And it would also prohibit Minnesota scientists from using these derived cells produced outside the state in their work, and would be a major interference in medical therapy and work on stem cell research. Is that your understanding, or what? Can you comment on that, please?
Representative Jedmer.
Chairman Smith, and I have a person here from the MCCL, Jordan Bauer. She would like to make some comments regarding that.
Ms. Bauer, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jordan Marie Bauer, and I am here on behalf of Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life, a grassroots organization with over 70,000 members and over 250 chapters. So thank you for allowing me to be here today. Representative Johnson, SCNT, or somatic cell nuclear transfer, sometimes referred to simply as nuclear transfer, is the scientific term for cloning. Scientists used to very commonly refer to human cloning as human cloning, but once polls started to show how strongly the American people opposed human cloning, they had to start using the more scientific terminology. So SCNT is the scientific term for cloning and incorporates both reproductive cloning and also includes therapeutic cloning, which would be cloning for the purposes of destruction for research.
Representative Hillstrom.
Mr. Chair, so could you explain to me, does this interfere with any of the stem cell research that's been going on, any of the research, for example, that is being done at the Mayo Clinic or the University of Minnesota?
Ms. Bauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, this bill only pertains to human cloning and the practice of human cloning. So,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But ultimately, it's how you define what cloning is. And so the question was, does it interfere with any of the research that's currently going on in the state of Minnesota?
Ms. Bauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this bill only applies to human cloning, and Subdivision 5 makes clear in its clarifying language that any of that other sort of research dealing with organs, cells, tissues, things like that would not be included in this legislation.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question relates to, I want to preface it with a comment. You know, when someone close to us dies, oftentimes there's a lot of soul searching to figure out reasons why, and people put together fundraisers and ask that donations be sent to foundations. I remember, when many people around here remember, when Doug Meslow's son died, and I think it was attended by almost by every member of this committee who was there at the time. And I remember talking to him at the time. His son died of leukemia, and he didn't bring up the topic specifically, but he did bring up the issue of what kind of research is going on that could have saved his son's life. I talked with other people in the family, and they really were urging that, encouraging that in lieu of flowers, that donations be sent to encourage this type of research that could potentially save the lives of people who had leukemia or cancer or other diseases. Would this bill impact the ability of those families with died loved ones to donate to foundations that could produce life-saving measures?
Mr. Chair, Representative, this bill only applies to human cloning and says that human cloning will not be happening in Minnesota, whether that's for reproductive or therapeutic purposes.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you. I understood that, but my question is it the same kind of research? I mean, could the research they're doing to end leukemia be the same kind of research that someone says, oh, that's cloning, because you're using the procedures that we define as cloning?
Ms. Bauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesch, no, this bill would not apply to that.
Okay.
Representative Lesch.
And why not?
Ms. Bauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, human cloning is very specifically defined in this legislation, and human cloning is exactly what we think of when we think of human cloning, creating an genetically identical copy of a human being. And this bill only applies to that.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you. But is a genetically identical copy of a human cell the same as the road to creating a genetically identical copy of a human being? Or do you have to have if someone stopped short of creating an entire human being with two arms, you know, and the head and whatnot, you know, does that fall short of the bill? As per how it's defined?
Ms. Bauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are a lot of other kinds of research that is happening that does not use human cloning, and that research would not be affected by this legislation.
Okay, thank you. I just final comment, Mr. Chair. My understanding in reading it is that it would, because inevitably when you do this the stem cell research and the other kinds of things, it goes down a road what people consider to be human cloning. So that's my concern. I'd like clarification from some other people on that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, I just, for example, I heard that we were creating or growing in some of our research in Minnesota organs, for example, for replacement. And would that count as cloning?
Ms. Bauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, can you repeat the question? I apologize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that some of the research that's going on in Minnesota is growing an organ, for example, for replacement. Would that be considered cloning?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, it would not be.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So where is the line between growing an organ and growing an entire body? Where does it cross over from growing an organ to being cloning? What's the line?
Ms. Bauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, human cloning entails the creation of a genetically identical human embryo to a human. Cloning an organ would be very different because you aren't creating a human embryo.
Any further questions? No one's been identified as further testifying. Therefore, the public testimony is now closed. The bill on the motion previously stated is before the committee. Any discussion? Hearing none on that motion, that the bill be recommended to pass, be referred to Health and Human Services Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Chairman Smith.
This time we'll move on to the next bill, which I would ask Vice Chair Szymanski to take over, House File 556, and I'd like to call all the witnesses to the table. Pages, if you could find some additional chairs. Jeff Bauer, the Family Partnership, Jim Backstrom, Dakota County Attorney, Eric Werner, Burnsville Police Captain, Heather Boyum, and Lisa Gagne will also provide testimony.
Good morning, Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. House File 556. Amends provision in statute for juvenile prostitutes found in need of protection or services. I'm going to ask Mr. Jeff Bauer of the Family Partnership to explain the bill.
Okay. Representative Smith, would you like to move your bill?
I'd like to move the bill that it be recommended to pass, and I'd ask you to lay it over.
Thank you, Representative Smith. And Mr. Bauer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members, for the opportunity to be here today. I'm Jeff Bauer. I'm the Public Policy Director at the Family Partnership, and proud to work with Representative Smith on this important piece of legislation. Many of the committee members have heard that the trafficking of juveniles in the state of Minnesota is a growing problem. There's a couple of things that we know. One is that a recent study by the Shapiro Group showed that between February and August of 2010, the incidences of child trafficking in Minnesota increased by 55%. That's a very alarming increase. The second thing that we know is in the state of Minnesota, the average age that a girl is first forced into prostitution is between the ages of 11 and 14. So just for your reference, that's a fifth grader at the age of 11. We also know that once these girls are forced in, that they are essentially stuck. They're brutalized, they're threatened, they cannot get back out. So there are a lot of really great law enforcement officials and prosecutors and service providers working on this issue, and we're going to hear from them in a minute. But one of the main complicating factors in our ability to deal with this issue effectively is Minnesota state law. There's a current conflict in our state law when it comes to dealing with girls who have been forced into prostitution. On the one hand, if you look at our child protection statutes in the state of Minnesota, one of the definitions of a child in need of protection and services is any child involved in prostitution. On the other hand, if you look at our criminal statutes as they relate to the crime of prostitution, that same child is treated as a criminal within our system. And so what we are trying to do with House File 556 is we want to remove that conflict from the law, and we want to make very, very clear that these children are crime victims and they are not criminals. So this bill does three main things. The first thing it does, like I said, is it removes the conflict. On the one hand, it takes prostitution out of the juvenile delinquency definitions. And on the other hand, on the criminal side, it states that anyone charged with a crime of prostitution must be 18 years of age or older. The second thing that it does is it charges the Commissioner of Public Safety, along with the Commissioners of Public Health, Human Services, and stakeholders, with creating a victim-centered model to deal with these children. You're sitting in Ramsey County right now. Ramsey County has a nationally recognized model for how to do this the right way. The third thing that this bill does is we need to find a way to pay for this. So right now in Minnesota, if you are an adult purchaser of adult prostitution services, the fine is $250, and it's a misdemeanor. That's a speeding ticket. And more often than not, that fine is waived. And so the third thing this bill does is it actually increases that fine level to between $500 and $750. And what it also does is it splits the revenue from that increased fine level between the arresting law enforcement agency for training on how to deal with sex trafficking crimes, between the prosecuting agency, and then service providers. And so we're not only increasing revenue, but we're incentivizing the application of this higher fine. So that's the three things the bill does. It's pretty straightforward. It's a clear message that we're not going to treat victims as criminals in Minnesota. This bill has been endorsed by the statewide human trafficking task force, as well as a variety of prosecutors and law enforcement officials from around the metro area and the state. And we're going to hear from a couple of them right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bauer. Representative Smith, please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, I invite, excuse me, James Baxter from Dakota County Attorney to offer some comments.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Baxter.
Committee members, I am James Baxter, the Dakota County Attorney. It is my privilege to be here before you today to testify in support of House File 556, also known as the Safe Harbor Bill. This is an important piece of legislation. It's an issue that was brought to my attention several months ago by newly elected Ramsey County Attorney John Choi, who approached me and approached some of my colleagues in the metropolitan area to discuss this issue of seeking to treat juvenile prostitutes as victims and not as criminals in our justice system. And as I thought about that and discussed it with my colleagues, I agreed that that is the right policy to follow. A little less than a month ago, we held a news conference in St. Paul. John Choi, myself, all of the Metro County Attorney's offices were represented, in addition to Olmsted County Attorney Mark Ostrom present as well, along with numerous members of our law enforcement community as supporting this proposal as well. And we established in the metropolitan area by policy in our offices exactly what this bill will establish statewide, and that is to seek, as as you have heard, to treat these exploited young women as the victims they rightfully are, and not as criminals under our system of justice. This is a serious problem in America. When you think, you heard about the statistics in Minnesota, how it's been growing fast, but when you think about the fact that there's between 1.6 and 2.8 million youth who run away each year in the United States, run away from home, these are young children starting from age 10 and on, who are putting themselves in the line of fire, so to speak, to become victims of juvenile prostitution as they're forced into these acts by the pimps and the Johns, the purchasers of these services. They are exploited, they are traumatized, and that trauma can be devastating to these young women. We had a chance to hear from several of those young women at the news conference we held, and one's going to speak to you briefly here in a moment. And I'll tell you how impressed I was with the courage that those young women showed by standing up and discussing their victimization. And it drove home to me the importance of pursuing this concept and establishing this policy, and now, with the passage of this bill, law in our state, to ensure that we do everything we can to protect these young women, get them out of the exploitation that they've been receiving at the hands of pimps, and to get them back into a healthy lifestyle. So I just wanted to offer my strong support for the bill, and I will turn it back to Representative Smith.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, at this time I'd also invite Eric Warner, Burnsville Police Captain, to offer some additional comments.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Warner, and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I want to thank you for inviting us here today. My name is Eric Warner. I'm a captain with the Burnsville Police Department, and I'm responsible for leading our street crimes unit. And on behalf of the Burnsville Police Department and my chief, Bob Hawkins, we want to express our support for this bill. Over the last numerous years, the Burnsville Police Department has trained with, has partnered with, and has enforced prostitution laws, which has included many agencies at the local level as well as the state level, and to include the St. Paul Police Department. We believe that prostitution is a metro-wide and statewide issue that has the potential to continue to grow with the use of the internet and social media sites, which we believe creates the opportunity to exploit these young victims. Our efforts have focused on the Johns. They're essentially the demand. They're the ones that create the need for the pimps to exploit these young children and provide the services to the Johns that seek their services. Our officers have experienced the devastating effects of the long-term effects, as I may emphasize, of these true victims that have been exploited early on and then have been put into a life of prostitution through horrible abuse and exploitation. We believe that this bill will help keep our children safe, provide the intervention and the treatment they need to get out of the life of prostitution, as well as it will send a message that they have a resource and a safe place to go, and hopefully they can gain their lives back. So once again, we want to emphasize that the Burnsville Police Department is supportive of this bill.
Thank you, Captain Warner. And Representative Smith, you have another testifier?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I'm going to remove myself from this chair and invite two additional testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Good morning. Please identify yourself.
Good morning. My name is Heather Boyum. I am a client of Breaking Free and an ex-prostitute. Thank you for this opportunity to be here today, Chairman Smith and all the representatives. I'm a little nervous. I have, since the first press conference that Jeff Power and John Choi, Ramsey County Attorney, had put together, I've been through the process and speaking at each of these gatherings or what have you. And I've had the opportunity to tell my story. And so once again, I am 31 today. I got into prostitution when I was 16. I was a minor. I got involved with a pimp through many false promises and broken dreams. To begin with, I thought he was my boyfriend. Shortly thereafter, I was being pimped out. I was seeing multiple numbers of Johns every day, every week. I got passed through three different pimps over the course of the last 15 years. I lost out on time with my family, time with my friends. I lost out on a lot of life. I got involved with Breaking Free in November. One of my kids' fathers lives up here in Minnesota. He had found Breaking Free. I called him, and within moments, I was part of the Breaking Free family. Had I known 15 years ago what I know now, that there is programs like Breaking Free available for women in prostitution, that there is a safe place to go, and that we're not going to be treated like criminals, especially when it's something that we've been forced into, my life would have been significantly different. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Boyum. And welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chairperson and committee members. Sorry, I'm a little bit nervous. My name is Lisa Gagne. I wrote something about myself. It's a little bit personal. It goes into my story just a little bit, just to give you an idea of myself and why I'm here and why I'm fighting for this bill, and it's important to me. Again, my name is Lisa, and I'm 38. I'm an only child, and I have no children of my own. My mother passed when I was 16 years ago, and I've never met my father or even knew his name. I don't want to get too specific or detailed, but I feel it is important that you know some things about me. I was raised by my grandparents in a caring yet stern environment. Though we never admitted it, my grandfather was an alcoholic. And then my grandmother turned her head and tried to hide the fact that he was. This led me to come to terms and understand my own battle with addiction as I grew older. I grew up in a house that believed that kids were seen and not heard. This is hard, being an only child. I was molested at the age of 5 by a boyfriend of a family member. This lasted for about 3 years, and later on when I was about 13, I tried to ask for help, tell what was happening, and I was accused of lying by everyone except for my mother. He was no longer around, and it was just brushed under the rug, so to speak. This leading me to understand my trust issues, also then and now. Went on to graduate high school and moved with my mother and attended college. My mother passed in 95, and I became involved in prostitution at the age of 22. I ran into an old acquaintance of mine that was a boyfriend, and I dated casually in the past, and he was into prostitution, and at that time I didn't really know it or understand it. Little did I know that I was making the worst decision of my life. From that point on, I was under a constant threat of physical violence, threats of all natures. I was manipulated and forced to recruit other young girls to do what I was doing. My job was to get them there, and he would handle it from there until there was a problem where they would not comply with what he wanted. This went on for about a year before I got a chance to get away. That was after countless beatings and degrading situations that I have been put through, not to mention the pain and the abuse of the other girls and women that were put through this abuse by the hands of me too. I guess what I'm trying to say is that sometimes we find ourselves in situations that we don't know quite how to get out of. And at the age of 22, you would think that I would have thought and would have been competent enough to know better. Through countless therapy sessions and meetings that I lost count of, I got a chance to realize why I made the decisions that I made. And at that time, I was vulnerable and easily preyed upon. No father figure, no mother, alone, afraid, confused, angry, desperate for attention. So just imagine yourself in my shoes at 22. Or imagine the situation at the age of 12. No family, no home, no trust, and all alone. if you could bear with me, and I would like you to imagine just a little further of the things I described, and at the age of 12 to 15, sometimes even younger, being shipped to another country that you know nothing about, and being forced to have sex with men and women, being beaten, raped, starved, emotionally and mentally starved for life. Now, I keep telling you to imagine the situation, but the thing is over 800,000 girls and boys, there's nothing imaginary about this. This is reality. Every 30 seconds, another person becomes a victim. Women are lured by traffickers with false promises of low-skilled jobs, domestic help, and other jobs, and then are forced to work as prostitutes. Traffickers tell these girls that they need to work off debts of thousands of dollars or more, and they are forced to sleep with upwards of 20 men a day. They are denied basic medical care and are subjected to horrific human rights violations. I don't have the exact numbers, but an estimated 14,000 to 17,000 women and children are trafficked in the United States every year. The highest cases of these being in New York, California, and Florida. Minnesota is one of the growing, having the most cases. Some victims of trafficking usually don't speak out for fear of retaliation. They are usually arrested for prostitution and then deported back to their home country with no consequences to the traffickers or the brothel owners. Or if they're native of this country, they're charged as adults. Even though I've forgiven myself for the things I've done in the past, I still feel a passion for helping others. I speak upon this bill because I feel that I can be the voice for young women and children that get trapped in this lifestyle, some by choice, some by force. Either way, sex trafficking is heartless, degrading, and morally wrong. And prosecuting our youth as adults just further distances them from a life that can be happy, safe, productive, and filled with hope. We need to show our youth out there that there are people that care about them that they've never even met, that love and care for them, and we're fighting for their lives and their future. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gagne. We have one question. Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifiers, you know, this is a despicable trade, and I hate to even refer to it as a trade. And but I would like to offer an oral amendment subject to the author's approval, is that all the fines listed in the bill be tripled, okay? And that the additional money over the stated fines be donated to programs that help our children and young people lead this type of lifestyle. Why shouldn't the people who are using the exploiting our children pay the price to help them lead the lifestyle? So again, to repeat my oral amendment, it would refer to lines 5.31 through 6.3, I would like to see all those fines tripled and the additional money over the stated fines be donated to programs that help our young people lead this lifestyle.
Representative Grunhagen, I would ask that you would consider withdrawing your amendment at this time, and the bill will be laid over for further consideration.
Mr. Chair, why would you have that request?
Well, we would prefer that you would work on a written amendment to address this issue so that we have more clarity to the whole process.
Okay, thank
Representative
you.
Smith?
Mr. Chairman, yes, this bill will be laid over. We'll have time to discuss, think about it and discuss it. I'm really not prepared to respond. I would note at this time, however, that tripling the fines would certainly have potentially a bed impact and might be prohibitive from that viewpoint. But it's worth discussion. I'd ask you to just hold it until we bring it back.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up comment. Thank you, Representative Smith. And the reason for that, we have higher fines for mistreating animals than we do for exploiting our young people. And that's one of the things that concerns me. And also, you know, you're dealing with young people, and the latest brain research shows that they, and one of the reasons they can be easily trapped and I will use the word enslaved in this type of and I see the ladies are shaking their head in agreement, is because they have young people until about my understanding is about 23 or 25 had the don't have the developed maturity brain-wise to properly weigh the consequences of all their actions. So there is the idea of personal responsibility, but you're also dealing with the maturity of a person's and development of a person's brain and their ability to properly weigh the consequences. That's why you do things when you're a teenager that you would never do later on in life and realize how ridiculous that is. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Mr. Bauer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Grunhagen, I just want to clarify in this bill, the fine level that you see in this bill is for an adult purchasing another adult for the purposes of prostitution. It's a misdemeanor. You can raise a misdemeanor fine level all the way up to $1,000, and then beyond $1,000, that's the ceiling for misdemeanor fine level. For adult purchasers of juvenile prostitutes, the fines are much higher and the penalties are much stiffer. What we were trying to get at was using the adult prostitution crimes and fines to help fund the services, but I do want to clarify the fines for those going after children are much, much higher, and the penalties as well.
Thank you, Mr. Bauer.
Thank you.
And Representative Lesch has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question relates to, kind of related to Representative Grunhagen's question, but I don't know much about the brain science of what motivates a young woman in this case, but I think maybe we just made that illegal in the last bill, so that brain science, so we wouldn't be burdened by the paltry contradictions of science. That said, when we are prosecuting a person for a crime, I wonder about the young woman who has no interest in participating in a program like Breaking Free, and I'm glad to hear you women testify about that, because I worked with Breaking Free for 10 years, and ensuring that it is a condition of probation that individuals participate in the Breaking Free program. And I think it's been a wonderful program, and I appreciate its presence there, because it's something that an independent organization can do that government has just not been able to do. But it does work in cooperation with government. And as I stated, we do make it a condition of probation. So to the extent, which I think is appropriate, to consider these young women as victims, yet what about the women that don't consider themselves victims? They don't want to participate. They don't want to cooperate. Really, the only thing we have to wake them up is probation hanging over their head. Is this bill taking away that option from prosecutors?
Attorney Backstrom,
Mr.
please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesch, it is my belief that we can accomplish those same goals through our child protection system. And when a juvenile is seen in this way as a victim, and if they're not willing to voluntarily accept some of the services that would be offered, we can certainly initiate a child protection proceeding and intervene to protect that child and accomplish, I believe, the same goals that we could in terms of getting the services that they need to help them and address some of those issues, even though they may be at that time, at least initially, unwilling to accept those services. We can accomplish that through our child protection process.
Thank you, Mr. Backstrom. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Backstrom, I watched the press conference that you recently had, and wasn't one of the discussions that took place during that press conference the ability to distinguish between those who were victims versus those who may not be victims and maybe making choices that many of us think are not appropriate choices, but either for drugs or alcohol or for some other reason? And does this bill take into account those concerns that were raised during the press conference?
Mr. Backstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I believe it does. I believe it does, again, through our child protection process that we can intervene to address those situations appropriately and when needed. And I do believe we have other crimes that exist if we needed to enforce them in certain situations. And I also just want to clarify, I didn't make this point earlier in my testimony, but I want to be very clear to this committee and to the legislature as we proceed. There's nothing in this bill that prohibits, nor should it prohibit, our ability as prosecutors to go after the people responsible for luring these children into prostitution, the pimps and the Johns that purchase these services, illicit services, need to be held accountable, and we will continue to aggressively pursue prosecutions for those individuals. But I do believe we can address the victimization of these children more appropriately in other ways than through the criminal process.
Thank you, Mr. Backstrom. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to say, usually in these hearings, I'm always asking what bang for the buck we get from all the little crime bills that we get going through this committee. And I just want to say that I really think this is a very good piece of legislation. I think we're going the right direction here, and I especially appreciate Representative Grunhagen's comments about children. I think too often we criminalize the behavior of children and pretend they're just little adults, and they're not. And this is one area where I think it's really appropriate to decriminalize this and treat children like children and give them the protection that they need. So I just wanted to make that comment. Thank you for bringing this.
Mr. Chairman, at this time, if you would check, see if there's any opposition testimony, and if not, I'd ask you to lay both the bill and the oral amendment over.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Smith. Is there anyone else in the gallery today wishing to testify for or against House File 556? If so, please come forward. Seeing none, Representative Smith would renew his motion to lay the House File 556 over, including the proposed oral amendment for further consideration. Thank you, Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Committee members, thank you for your time and your patience. I appreciate Mr. Bauer from the Family Partnership, County Attorney James Backstrom for coming today and testifying, Captain Werner for taking his time to come, and of course, Heather and Lisa for sharing their personal stories. Mr. Chairman of the committee, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Smith.
At this time, I'd like to bring House File 868 before the committee. It's the intention of the chair to take testimony and then lay the bill over. Representative Shemansky, a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to move for consideration House File 868 for discussion at this time and lay over for further consideration.
Good. The motion before us is that the bill 868 be recommended to pass and be referred to Civil Law Committee, but then we will not vote. We will lay it over. Representative Shemansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House File 868 is a pretty straightforward bill, basically looking at the limits of conciliation court and raising those limits. The caps on conciliation claims have not been raised for several years, and today I would ask Mr. Bruce Clavin to give us some testimony on the rationale for increasing the limits on conciliation court.
Very good. Before we proceed, besides the two gentlemen at the table, is there anyone in the audience who wants to be heard in support of this bill? Raise your hand. In opposition to the bill, also raise your hand. Mr. Elwood, anyone else? All right, gentlemen, go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bruce Clavin, I represent the Cooperative Network, formerly the Minnesota Association of Cooperatives. This is an issue our members brought forth 3 years ago, and as Representative Shemansky mentioned, it's a pretty straightforward bill. I do want to thank him for taking this on. I came to see him in his office, and within a matter of minutes, he agreed to do it, and I want to thank him for that, and also, Mr. Chairman, for putting us on the agenda today. The conciliation court caps were, for the conciliation court law was actually first passed in 1971. The limit at that time was $300. So if your claim was less than $300, you could go to conciliation court. You don't need an attorney. There's no discovery. It's quite a bit cheaper. Anyway, in the first 23 years of that law's existence, the caps were moved up 9 times to the current level of $7,500 and $4,000 for consumer credit claims. So for the last 17 years, the cap has been flat at $7,500. This bill simply raises that to $15,000. And before I get a question on why $15,000, it came from the Senate author in 2009, Senator Ortman, who said, well, let's just double it. And I said, okay. So that was how the bill came to be. I've been talking with Mr. Elwood about, is there some other number to be used here? And certainly we'll keep talking about that. Maybe there's some agreement on that eventually. But anyway, in 2009, this bill made it all the way through the Senate. It was in the conference committee that we had on this bill in room 112. It was dropped. House members didn't agree with it. We never got a hearing in the House. Representative Olin carried it that year in the House. And so in 2010, we didn't do anything with it, and we're back now this year trying to do it. Last comment I make would be on fiscal notes, in case we get a question on that. I don't recall a fiscal note in 2009, but there may be one in terms of filing fee revenue and so forth that the Supreme Court may be concerned about, but I don't know of one to date. So, Mr. Chairman, with me today is Tim Kavanaugh, one of our members, who also will have some brief testimony for you.
Mr. Kavanaugh, thank you. Identify yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tim Kavanaugh. I'm the general manager of Federated Co-ops in Princeton, Minnesota. I'm testifying on behalf of the Cooperative Network, which is a trade association representing all cooperatives in Minnesota. My co-op is has 35,000 members. We operate on the eastern side of Minnesota with 26 locations. Primarily, we sell energy products and farm supplies. Minnesota, as you know, has a lot of cooperatives. The units are managed locally by boards of directors, and all earnings are distributed back to members. I think last year the co-ops contributed about $18 billion in economic activity in the state and paid about $146 million in taxes. I appreciate the opportunity to speak regarding this legislation. I think increasing the cap from $7,500 to $15,000 is important because it allows cooperatives to handle these kind of issues outside of district court. My cooperative last year spent just over $12,000 on attorney's fees handling these in district court. Typically, we would spend somewhere between that and $20,000 a year. I think raising the limit would simply reflect the inflationary increase in the cost of goods and services that we sell. In closing, I'd like to ask the committee for your support of this legislation, and thank you for allowing me to testify.
Mr. Clavin?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to correct my testimony, I was handed a fiscal note dated yesterday, so there is one. I'm just looking at it now, so thank you.
Any questions from the committee of either of these two testifiers? If not, Mr. Elwood.
Morning. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. First of all, I want to thank Representative Szymanski. You know, there's only two choices here, support and oppose, but really is a third way, which is why I'm here. I just want to raise some concerns, but also acknowledge and thank Representative Szymanski because he has, and Mr. Clevin, because they've agreed to kind of work with me to see if we can't modify the bill a bit. And my concern is, as drafted, the bill really skews the fair balance between litigants in this forum by moving too far away, in my view, from the purpose of conciliation court in the first place, which is simply the resolution of small amount monetary disputes between citizens. So as the amount in dispute increases to this significant level, the imbalance between pro se litigants and represented litigants becomes more and more problematic, and that's the concern I have here. And finally, in a similar vein, I think we really need to be careful to ensure that you know, a forum where the as mentioned, the rules of evidence and other judicial procedures are really relaxed, that they're dealing with appropriate matters of appropriately smaller amounts. So, as I said, we'll be working with the author and the proponents, and I thank the committee for the time today to raise the concerns.
Mr. Elwood, thank you. Any questions of this testifier? Representative Maleen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Elwood, is there a record kept in conciliation court of the proceedings?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Maleen, I don't really know.
Mr. Chair, because from my understanding, there's no court reporter in conciliation court, and there's actually no record kept of the proceedings, and there are lower evidentiary standards, as you mentioned. So I'm wondering, with the right to appeal a loss in conciliation court, then you go to district court, but it's actually like starting all over again. Is that right?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair, Representative Maleen, I believe that is correct.
Representative Maleen.
Mr. Chair, so I guess I have concerns with how much more money that will actually cost the court system, because if someone appeals their loss in conciliation court and then they file in district court, then the court is basically rehearing the same case. So that's my concern. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this morning, Representative Szymanski, I appreciate your willingness to work with Mr. Elwood. I think he has raised some important concerns, particularly about the purpose of conciliation court, if in fact it is to be a, to resolve issues between individuals more so than businesses. It seems like 15,000 is kind of a high number, and there could be something found that's a little bit more reasonable to work out. So I appreciate your willingness to work on those issues.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Szymanski, didn't we just raise the limit? And do we know the consequences yet of raising the limit?
Mr. Claven.
Representative Hillstrom, I will let Mr. Claven answer, but I believe it had something to do with the forfeiture law changes that took place last year.
Mr. Claven.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, sir, Representative Hillstrom, you look on line 1.11. It did raise to 15,000 if the claim involves money or personal property subject to the forfeiture law. So that, I think, went through last year. It was not in place in 2009, so that was part of the forfeiture discussion last year. When Senate Council put this together, they just struck that because all the limits under here were going to 15,000. So you're right in terms of the forfeiture.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do we know, have we seen more incidences yet? I mean, do we have any assessment of how much we're using that amount?
Mr. Claven.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, I do not have an answer to that. I don't know. I didn't follow any of the forfeiture law or any of the cases that have come since.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think that we need to try to assess when we do raise an amount, you know, what the consequences will be, and if we've already done it, what, you know, what impact it has had. So if we could find out if there's been any impact, that would be helpful later.
Very good. Any other questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I also have concerns about this. And first of all, you know, I was somewhat involved in the forfeiture dispute last session, and I think it's the forfeiture issue is really very different, because that involves someone whose property has been taken, and it's always between a particular set of litigants. So I think that's a really different issue. But I have grave concerns about raising this to 15,000. That's an enormous amount of money for most people, and granted, that would be the upper limit, but you know, I think often things are very informal in conciliation court, and often what ends up happening is that you kind of split the difference. It becomes more of a mediation almost. And with 15,000, that is a huge amount of money to most people. I mean, you know, a lot of people don't make $15,000 in a year. So, you know, I think this is an awfully big jump to just kind of arbitrarily double the limit, and I'm glad you're going to work with Mr. Elwood on that, and hope that his advice will be listened to on this one. Thank you.
Representative Detmer. Chemaski, excuse me.
Mr. Chairman, we've been mistaken before.
I'm living in the past, excuse me.
Mr. Chairman, the other consideration that we haven't addressed extensively is the raising the limit also remove some of the cases from district court. In other words, lightening the burden for our district courts, which are already hard-pressed. And so we felt that by raising the limits in conciliation court, we can take some burden off the district court.
We will be discussing this bill again. Chair is going to lay it over. The public testimony is closed. There's no other testifiers. Any further discussion or questions? All right. Chair lays the bill over. Thank you, gentlemen, and Representative Chemaski.
Representative Smith, welcome before the committee once more this morning. The chair would like to bring House File 987 before the committee. It's the chair's intention to lay over House File 987. Representative Smith, would you like to move your bill?
Mr. Chairman, yes. I've got four bills here in succession. I'm asking the committee hear them. If there are questions, we'll try to answer them. And it would be my intent as chairman to have these in reserve for possible inclusion in the in our omnibus bill, House File 987. I would like to move the bill. It's a public defender reimbursement purpose. Under current law, the courts may seek partial payments or reimbursements for public defender services. These funds are credited to an account and dispersed by the Public Defense Board to the District Public Defender's Office based on the amount of funds ordered by each district. According to Minnesota Statute 611.20 Subdivision 3, the District Public Defender's Office receiving these funds is required to use the money to supplement office overhead payments to part-time public defenders. By statute, the Public Defense Board is required to provide an annual report on the amount of funds distributed to the District Public Defender's Office. According to fiscal year 2010 report, for example, $430,328 in reimbursements was distributed to the 10 judicial districts. The 7th District received the most with $112,393 compared to the 4th District, Hennepin County, receiving only $896. When evaluated by case unit, the 5th District had the highest reimbursement per case unit rate at $7.51 per case unit, while the 4th District had the lowest at 1 cent per case unit, followed by the 2nd District at 7 cents per case unit. The 4th District, again Hennepin County, and the 2nd District is Ramsey County. Hennepin County has no part-time defenders and thus no part-time defender overhead. Ramsey County part-time defenders are county employees with a little or no overhead costs. I can't say for certain that there is a correlation between the lack of a need for part-time overhead reimbursement and the ordering of reimbursements. However, the current statute clearly provides no incentive for judges in certain areas to order partial payment or reimbursements when they know those funds are statutorily limited. The purpose of this repeal and this proposed bill is to give the public defender system the flexibility it should have in applying these reimbursement funds to best serve the mission of their offices and remove any unintentional disincentives in ordering partial payments or reimbursements. Finally, and in closing, from the Legislative Auditor's Evaluation Report on the Public Defender System, the report made the following observation, and I quote, "Judge and court officials said that judges have an incentive to order reimbursements when reimbursement receipts go to district public defender programs, unquote, and thus recommended that the legislature eliminate the requirement that reimbursement funds be distributed among part-time public defenders and instead give the Board of Public Defense authority to use the funds as they see fit.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Representative Wesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith, when was this law first enacted?
I want to ask our attorney staff to help me with that.
Okay. And while they're looking for that, Mr. Okay. Chair.
Representative Wesch, we'll have a witness here to testify.
Mr. Chairman and members, for the record, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator with the Board of Public Defense. Mr. Chairman and Representative Lesch, reimbursements have been part of the public defender appointed counsel statute going back to the 1960s.
Okay.
The current version of what you see before you was enacted in 1998 by the legislature.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesch.
Mr. Kyer, not getting into too much, but I do have a brief question because of another follow-up. Are the public defenders supportive of this legislation?
Mr. Kyer.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lesch, the board doesn't have a position on this. They're actually meeting next week. Our position practically has been we would rather not have those cases and have encouraged the judges. I think you heard Mr. Ward here a couple of weeks ago say, rather than get those appointments and then order reimbursement, is to not have those cases appointed to us at all, because the reimbursements never cover the cost of actually doing the representation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
And I gather the collection issue is there as well, and I wonder if then you have to go collect on it, if that just adds another case to the court system to collect on it. So I can see why you'd be in that position, Mr. Kyer, too. I generally would say this, Representative Smith, I'm very supportive of it because it's been a frustration of mine that the percentages in Hennepin and Ramsey County are, I think, a product of culture, that the judges on the bench and generally the legal system doesn't want to have to deal with this because we do have the highest concentration of defendants in poverty in the state, I believe, and dire poverty. So a lot of judges are just saying, you know, what's the point? Move the cases through. I don't know about reimbursement, despite the fact that I fought it, and I think there's an attitude also about it's going to take more resources to get the money out of them than not. That said, I think it is a matter of justice for the person who is having to wait for their public defender, for someone who could pay for a private attorney. At the end of the day, when it comes down to it, yes, as a matter of justice, I think they should have to reimburse. That said, let my support not be qualified by my thoughts that the real need here is to fund the public defenders through the system that we have historically funded them. That is through the general fund. That is through our general revenues of how we need to do this. We don't need to nickel and dime them with reimbursements as a way to say, okay, well, now we've defunded the public defender because they're going to get reimbursements. That's not going to cut the mustard at all here. That said, as I said, for my reasons, Representative Smith, I do support the bill.
Representative Smith, any follow-up?
No, just thank you, Representative Lesch.
All right. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Smith, now the 4th District has no part-time attorneys, or Mr. Kaher, either one, public defender, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, they do not have any state part-time public defenders. If you recall, in Hennepin and Ramsey, the county employees were grandfathered in when the state took over or assumed the cost of public defense in those two districts. So no new hires are county employees, but they do have county part-timers. This statute doesn't impact those folks.
And in the 2nd Judicial District, do they use Criminal Defense Services, Inc.? Does that affect? I'm just wondering if those two facts impact the reimbursement to those judicial districts.
Mr. Kyer.
Where I'm going with
Mr.
That.
Chairman and Representative Johnson, Criminal Defense Services, Inc. has operated in Ramsey County for a number of years. In fact, we actually provide them some office space in our office there. And what they are is they're basically a low-cost provider. They have a number of criminal defense lawyers who have agreed to take marginally eligible clients for reduced fees, mostly on misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors. And so that does impact the reimbursements, because those folks would probably end up being public defender clients and ordered reimbursement. Instead, they're Criminal Defense Service Incorporated clients. So.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Kier. There being no further witnesses, public testimony is now closed. Is there any further discussion among the committee on House File 987? Hearing no further discussion, the chair lays over House File 987 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or further action at a later time.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to take up House File 988 next. I'll move the bill and ask you, when we're done with it, to lay it over also.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Please proceed.
All right. Mr. Chairman and committee members, this bill also addresses some of the recommendations made by the Legislative Auditor's Evaluation Report on the PD system from January 2010. It contains some provisions brought to me by the Office of the Public Defense Court. I'm going to go through each section briefly. Section 1. This language was brought to me by the Office of the Public Defenders. Under the Constitution, an accused is entitled to representation when facing loss of liberty, which generally includes felonies, gross misdemeanors, and misdemeanors. An accused is not entitled to representation in defending against a petty misdemeanor, where there is no option for jail time. This section 1 of the bill would require the court to ask if the prosecutor intends to certify the case as a petty misdemeanor, and if so certified, no public defender would be appointed. That's section 1. Section 2 also was brought forward by the public defenders to clarify that public defenders are only to be requested by those who qualify for appointment for a public defender in Minnesota Statute 611.14 by removing language reading as follows, quote, or any other person entitled by law to representation by counsel, unquote. This avoids confusion, or is aimed at avoiding confusion, in the role of the PD in areas of civil law where the statute might reference a right to have representation but not a public defender. That's section 2. Section 3 contains language brought also by the Public Defense Board with some additional revisions that I've included. It amends 611.17 to include fixed income standards as follows. A misdemeanor defendant can earn up to 125% of federal poverty guidelines, gross misdemeanor up to 150%, and a felony earning up to 175%. It allows the court to assign a public defender if the defendant, through any combination of liquid assets and current income, would not afford reasonable costs charged by private counsel in that judicial district for defense of the same matter. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court requires judges be given discretion outside of a strict income eligibility standard, but this language would still have the court to do due diligence in assessing a need outside the guidelines. So instead of assuming automatic eligibility, it's setting these levels. It amends also 611.17 subdivision B to clarify that the language instructing the court to make an appropriate determination based on financial eligibility, it strengthens the current statutory language requiring a person receiving PD services to disclose any changes in financial circumstances. It requires the court to use a uniform financial statement furnished by the state PD, and it removes existing statutory language prohibiting the PD from performing a financial inquiry. Further, it amends subsection C of that same statute to allow the $75 copayment for public defender services to be waived in part as well as in full. The current statute simply allows the copayment to be ordered paid or waived in full. Also, it amends 611.17 to add a new paragraph sub D
as shown on the bill, to clarify to the courts that a PD is not to be appointed to a defendant who is financially able to retain counsel but simply refuses to do so, or refuses to execute the financial statement, or refuses to provide information necessary to determine financial eligibility, or waives the appointment of a public defender. And that's subdivision three. Moving on to number four section, I should say, it was in large part language provided by the public defenders in amending 611.18 on the process of appointing a PD and the use of the appellate public defender. We're striking language, as you can see, in the current statute that allows a public defender to assist persons accused of a crime who appear financially unable to obtain counsel until it is determined they are able to afford counsel. We may consider an amendment later to this language to preserve the constitutional right to representation during questioning without requiring a predetermination of financial eligibility. In Section 5 of the bill, it amends Statute 611.20 sub 4 to add, quote, ability to pay, unquote, as a criteria for being ordered to make partial payments or reimbursements. Under the current statute, Subdivision 4 only applies to, quote, employed defendants, unquote, and being employed is no guarantee of financial ability, and being unemployed is no guarantee of financial inability. Therefore, the intent of the statute is to allow the courts to recover some costs from those defendants who will, with some means to make payments regardless of their employment statute. It further amends 611.20 by adding a new paragraph B that reads in part, if a court determines that a defendant is financially unable to pay the reasonable cost charged by private counsel due to the cost of a private retainer fee, the court shall evaluate the defendant's ability to make partial payments or reimbursement. Section 5 further amends Subdivision 4 by instructing the court in determining the amount of partial payment to consider the income and assets of the defendant based on the financial statement. Also strikes language referencing guidelines in Subdivision 6. Section 6 of the bill, in closing, repeals Subdivision 6 of 611.20, which is the income guideline grid the courts may use to determine a reimbursement schedule. The current statute is permissive in using the word, quote, may, unquote, and according to the legislative auditor's report that I referenced earlier, only 14% of judges usually or always use these guidelines, while 35% never use the guidelines. And so I believe this also was suggested by the public defenders. That's it, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Smith. We have questions. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith, so who in the civil area that currently is eligible for a public defender would not get one based on the changes that you're making?
Representative Smith.
I'm going to ask for counsel for his thoughts on that, Mr. Diebel.
Okay. All right. Mr. Diebel, would you like
to? My friend, Mr. Kyer, here.
All right. We'll defer to Mr. Kyer for this answer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, It wouldn't eliminate that right. What it does is it would say you don't have a public defender. We have had cases in the past, and not a lot of them, where public defenders have been appointed to represent folks in civil matters. One that comes to mind is a trust case we had a few years ago. Normally they're associated with family court or with some of those child protection issues. So they still have appointed counsel. It wouldn't be a public defender. And
all right. Thank you, Mr. Kyer. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. So, Mr. Kyer, this is not wading into the CHIPS cases at all, the children in juvenile court who currently get a public defender that's not really necessarily criminal. So that isn't mucking around in juvenile court at all or children. Is that correct?
Mr. Kyer. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, correct.
Okay. And Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. So, Representative Smith, if someone is given a public defender and then partway through it
You know, they get mad at their public defender and they say they don't want a public defender anymore. Would this bill require that the judge dismiss the public defender based on your statements about if someone waives the public defender? Because, in fact, I've seen a case where the judge refused to dismiss the public defender because the grounds, of course, under which they were being terminated or asked to stop representing the case, the judge did not believe was valid. So under this language, would that require the dismissal of the public defender?
Representative Smith. Welcome to the committee, sir. Would you please introduce yourself?
And I will. Mr. Chair, members, my name's Steve Holmgren. I'm the Chief Public Defender in the 1st Judicial District. And I'm sorry, I've been asked to respond to your question, but I didn't quite understand it.
Representative Hillstrom, would you repeat your question, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So one of the things that we've heard from the court is that people who are pro se kind of gum up the works, right? That it slows down the process. And so I have seen cases where, you know, the public defender is appointed and then the client gets mad for some reason and then comes in and says, you know, I don't want a public defender anymore. But they refuse to hire counsel or whatever. And so at that point, the judge says, no, based on your complaint, we're going to keep the public defender on and you guys need to work it out. With this new language that's in the bill where the person waives the public defender, would that require the judge to dismiss a public defender if the client does that?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Representative, it's hard to say whether it would require a judge. I think the public defender certainly could argue that it would. If a person's refusing to cooperate by providing financial information, for example, or not complying with the statute, it would certainly allow the court to consider that. Whether it would require them to, it's difficult to say because I know judges take the position generally that they have some sort of inherent duty to make sure that folks are represented appropriately. So I would be hard pressed to say that it would prohibit it because I know that every judge in the state might have a different opinion on it, but I think certainly it would raise the issue and provide a forum for discussion of whether it's appropriate to continue on.
Okay. Further questions, Representative Hillstrom? Or?
You can come back to me in a minute. Right. I can think about
Thank
it.
You, Representative Hillstrom. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith, or I guess my first question is to the Public Defense Board. Do you folks support this bill? I wasn't clear on that point. You brought it forward, is that what Chair Smith said?
Yeah. Mr. Kyer?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Johnson, we did bring a number of these provisions forward, including the income guidelines, as Representative Smith mentioned. Those are some recommendations from the Legislative Auditor's Report. It is similar to a bill that Representative Hillstrom carried 2 years ago. So, yes. We do have some concerns, and Mr. Holmgren, I think, is going to talk about two or three concerns that we have on the bill. But
Mr.
Right. I'll defer to Representative Johnson first, if you had further.
Go ahead, if you had something.
Or Representative Hillstrom.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make it clear, I carried the bill at the public defender's request. It wasn't my bill.
Right.
It didn't become law. I was the chair. We didn't pass it. But I carried it at your request.
Yes, you did.
Mr. Kyer.
Yes.
All right. Are there any further questions? Yep. Representative Johnson?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, my concern, just looking at the information, is basic access to justice. If I look at the income level limits of working guy's making $9.50 an hour, which isn't unheard of these days. I mean, that's kind of what a lot of people make, at least in the district I represent. That would, if he was charged with a felony, that would put him over the income limits for getting a public defender, and I don't see how he'd have enough money to hire private counsel. So it just seems like it's not a good deal for access to justice. I mean, just from a common sense perspective. So what's your comment on that? Am I misunderstanding it? But it doesn't seem like it works out well for the common Joe.
Mr.
Chairman, if I might, Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I think that the language that the authors included on lines 2.22 through 2.25 regarding, there's always an out clause, if you will, for the court to determine that there is substantial hardship to the defendant or defendant's family. So they could find that for example, in that case that you mentioned, that somebody's accused of, let's say, a very serious felony, and they are that person that maybe just barely doesn't qualify. But there is that ability for the court to have that discretion, if you will.
Representative Johnson.
Sure. Well, what if it's a gross misdemeanor then? Or, I mean, either way, if it's a offense that it's going to be a problem for a person, and they're just getting by on a certain amount of money, they can't get a public defender then.
Mr. Kier.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Johnson, I should have been more clear. The lines 2.22 through 2.25 are not exclusive to felony, so the court would have that discretion in any of the cases.
All right. We have a question from Representative Moline.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the author, for the testifiers, and I just wanted to follow up with Representative Johnson's comment about who would qualify under this new language. And I actually did the math, and if you make under the new language, 9.17 an hour, 40 hours a week, 52 weeks a year, you'd actually make too much to qualify for representation on a felony case. So I'm wondering, this new language, how many people are going to be cut out from felony representation from what the current law is?
Mr. Kier?
Mr. Chairman and members, as I testified, I think it was 2 years ago on the bill that we had brought forward, is we really don't know. What we would like to see, and I think what the court and what the legislative auditor has talked about, is having more of a statewide standard and having more consistency. Hopefully bringing some consistency, hopefully, and I believe the intent of the author is to give the court the tools to bring that consistency across the state, so that we don't have some of these issues come up in terms of, you know, well, somebody was eligible in this district, but they weren't eligible in that district, or even within counties. So we really don't know. So I guess that's the best answer I can give you right now. We don't think it's going to have a great impact, but it will bring that consistency, hopefully, or give the court another tool.
Thank you, Mr. Kier. We have a question from Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have grave concern about this, and some of that's been stated already. You know, this clause that was referred to, lines 2.22 to 2.25, that doesn't help, because what are we going to do? In almost every case, the court is going to be making a written finding, because, you know, it just seems to me that we're on a big downward spiral here. You know, obviously the public defender is far underfunded. It's caused a huge problem for the courts. We've heard about that, the backup of all the cases. You know, we like to think we're upping penalties for various things, and yet we can't get people through the system. You know, now it just seems to me that we're just moving toward more and more into a system of just cheap justice, where the lawyer, if you're lucky enough to get a public defender assigned, they've got no time for your case anyway. And then now we're just saying more people are just going to have to go it alone. And that's just going to clog up the courts further. I just think this is going entirely in the wrong direction. And, you know, the levels that have been cited here, for goodness sakes, if you're charged with a felony, and let's not forget that you can be charged with a felony and be entirely innocent. You know, I mean, we're not talking about, you know, people like to think, oh, these are criminals, you know. Well, when you're charged with an offense, you're presumed innocent, and many times you are innocent. So, you know, and I know the public defenders here know this, but it just really gives me grave concern about the direction that we're going here, and then we want to lower these limits and, you know, make sure that, you know, people that are working for a living and just, you know, honest working people like Representative Johnson was talking about, who are, you know, just getting by, they can't afford lawyers. This is just a charade to think that, You know, people can go into court and somehow find a lawyer who's going to help them, even on a misdemeanor case, and be able to afford that. It's just not realistic. I just think that we're basically depriving Minnesotans of the justice that they deserve. I hope we can do better than this.
All right. Would you like to reply, Mr. Holmgren or Mr. Kyer? All right. Hearing none. Before we resume questioning here, is there anyone else in the gallery that would like to testify for or against House File 988? Would you raise your hand? Okay. We have. Just note that for right now, and then I will resume with Representative Johnson's question here next.
I think, Chair Shemansky, Chair Smith, I think you referred to the OLA report on the public defender system. Now, when I look at that, and it talks specifically about the fact that district court judges report wide differences in how they weigh eligibility factors for public defender, and they have the district court judges report a little confidence in the accuracy of information they use to assess defendants' financial circumstances. And so it doesn't sound like they're doing a very good job. So then I wonder, when I look at this 2.22 through 2.25, I wonder how in the world is that going to work? Or when I look at the end of the bill where the court is considering income and assets of the defendant to make determination on make it more difficult to get public defense. It just seems like it just points to the fact it's even more problematic than on the surface. So I guess to Mr. K here or the other testifier, any comments on that?
Okay. Mr. Kyer?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Johnson, I think that there was a mixed bag in that legislative audit report. I think you have to read it in context. Is part of, I think, the issue is that there is kind of a broad standard in the statute, at least the auditor did find. And I think that lends to some of the issues of just differences even within a judicial district in terms of folks who are eligible. There's no question that there are differences, as we go from judicial district to judicial district. And I think part of that, and part of, I think, what the judges identified, or at least the ones who responded to the legislative auditor survey, was that there wasn't any clear definition. So, as I said, this is a recommendation of the auditor. We don't know if it's going to work, but we do know that we believe it will give the court some opportunity to have a tool that they're going to be able to better use to hopefully do a better job of screening, or a more consistent one. As I think we testified here a couple of weeks ago, I think by and large the court does a very good job, but they're under some stress too, as you've heard. So,
thank you, Representative Johnson.
Just to that point, I mean, the report says they have little confidence in the accuracy of information they use to assess the defendant's financial circumstances. So when you look at the guidelines, then they're basically saying they don't trust information they get to even make sense out of the guidelines. So I just don't see how that works.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having spent a lot of time in the courtroom as a new lawyer, the newest lawyers in the office get the least popular calendar to do, right? You kind of get to do the bail calendar, and you get to do, kind of all the cases that nobody else wants to do. So for 1 month, I did the morning bail calendar, and that's where they were evaluating the public defender forms. And ultimately, you would see some of the judges be very upset at the defendants for just putting zeros all down the form. So there's really no way to assess, whether the person really has zero or doesn't have zero, and you don't have access really to their assets. So I think that there is a frustration with some judges that there really isn't a good way to assess whether or not this person is being truthful or whether or not they really have any assets. But what I did find is that it goes really slow when there isn't a public defender.
when they don't have someone to make their bail argument, when the defendant doesn't have someone to make the bail argument. So what I did see was a lot of judges asking the public defender to stand in as a friend of the court to help the process along so that you could actually get through and finish the calendar. I also have done a case against a pro se litigant, which would normally take a few minutes if you had a public defender, but in fact went on for a very long time. So my question is, if you end up with more and more folks without a public defender, won't the court figure out a way to ask someone to step in as a friend of the court to keep the court moving along? Or won't you have many more cases going on because everyone has the right to make their own argument? And if they don't have a lawyer, they can take it to trial just as easily as someone who does have a lawyer. And in fact, it does take a lot longer. They challenge things that most public defenders would say, you know what, you don't have a case here, that, you know, or the public defender can turn to them and say, look, you're getting a really good deal here. You should probably take it because you're going to be found guilty, and the consequence after being found guilty is going to be way worse than what you're being offered right now. So don't you lose some of that time-saving court situation when you reduce the number of folks who have public defenders?
Mr. Holmgren, would you like to answer that question?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I think you're right in a lot of ways. The court is very inclined to want to get the public defender involved in cases. That's clear. But my view of this bill, and I think this hasn't been brought before the committee, is that in a lot of ways this bill expands eligibility. I can tell you in some counties right now, judges are using a strict 125% poverty guideline cutoff for all cases, regardless of whether it's a felony or a gross misdemeanor or a misdemeanor. And this bill allows you to have additional income to be up to 175% and still be presumptively eligible for the public defender. Judges will take advantage of the Section 4 where they can make findings by looking at the circumstances and saying, look, I think under the circumstances this person should be eligible and I will appoint the public defender. I think that happens now. And I think actually if this bill, it's just my opinion, but I think it's fairly sound, that if it didn't have that sort of override provision where the judge could make the determination, that it would be unconstitutional, because I don't think you can strictly determine public defender eligibility simply by income. So I think in a lot of ways, this will make it a fairer system. And I don't think that's been brought up to this point, but I agree with you. I do believe that judges will be inclined. They want to do the right thing. Everybody wants the right thing done here. It's just as it is right now, it is so all over the board as far as what one judge feels is appropriate versus another judge. And at least this brings sort of presumptiveness, eligibility or ineligibility into the game. We can start at that point of saying, all right, this person has this amount of income, but we'll also look at the circumstances, this person's individual circumstances, and it allows the override. So at least as a practicing public defender, that's the positive I see about this, is that it would help facilitate the discussion and give sort of a framework to be able to have some sense as to what your typical generic person would, whether they would be eligible or not if there is such a person.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Holmgren. Representative Hillstrom, our time for this committee is running thin. If we can keep these
question.
Very short questions, we do have two more people that would like to testify on this bill. So please allow time for them to get their message in.
Mr. Chair, the one challenge that we have that you don't really have is that when we do our bills, we do fiscal notes that say this is going to reduce your caseload by X number of dollars, so we cut you X number of dollars. And so what happens is if you set these guidelines in and you expand the caseload in some places and you reduce it in others, the money we give you is going to be reflective of that. We're expecting you're not going to get those cases because the guidelines say you're not going to get them. if the judges then appoint them anyways, you're going to come back and you're going to have less money, fewer public defenders to actually represent the people that you get. So you got to make sure that you're careful so that the bills that we have actually reflect what's really going to happen. And that's it.
Thank you. Is there a reply, Mr. Holmgren? Okay. Mr. Holmgren, you had raised your hand that you wanted to testify further in regard to this bill. There is one other gentleman in the audience that would also like to testify.
Mr. Chair, and members, just briefly, if I may, I'd just like to point out that current law nor this bill includes spousal income into the consideration here of public defender eligibility, when in reality all of the forms in the state that people fill out include spousal income. And that's important because even though a person may have a low or a low income, doesn't necessarily mean that their spouse couldn't contribute in some way to this. And it's important for the judges to be able to look at the whole mix of assets that are available to a person when making the decision. Secondly, the current statute requires that the court conduct the eligibility determination and exempts the public defender from doing that. This bill would allow the court to shift the burden of determining eligibility to the public defender. And that's a concern for us. First of all, because we don't necessarily have the resources nor the time to go through all the financial situations with potential applicants. The way the system typically works now in my district is that while the court is going through the applications for public defender and granting them, we're then talking to the client, preparing for the court process. So it's a real efficient system now with the court doing that. Eligibility determination gives us time to work the cases. And if we had to do both, that would certainly change the process considerably. And it also, that change would also put us in the position of potentially being adverse to our client. I mean, oftentimes we would need to talk to our folks about assets and eligibility, and if if they were denied the public defender, we could potentially be a witness if in fact later in the case they claim that they were wrongfully denied the public defender. They could look at us and make a claim that we participated in that. Also, there has been prosecutions in Dakota County for people making false statements on public defender applications. That would again put us as a potential witness if in fact we're conducting the inquiry in those situations. My point really is that the judge is in a position to make these determinations. They're sort of a neutral by their nature and are much better off making those decisions. And then finally, the line 4.20, there's a provision that prohibits us from doing case work until we're appointed. I'd just like the committee to be aware that we currently do work for people who are in jails in County A, and maybe a judge says, okay, I'll serve 30 days and then I want you released to a treatment facility, but they have a hold in County B. And as the public defender in County B, they'll often call us. They'll say, hey, can you get the hold dropped in County B so I can go to treatment? We can take care of that pretty simply by talking to prosecutors and the judges. And that saves counties transport costs. It saves counties and courts court appearance time. And I just wanted to point that out, that there's a lot of efficiencies that could be lost if, in fact, we're not able to sort of pick the cases for people who are in jail, previously qualified for the public defender in County A, for example. And I just want the committee to be aware of that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Holmgren. And would the other fellow that wanted to testify please come forward? Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony. You realize that we only have about 3 minutes left in this committee period. So,
my name is Tim Kinley. Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. I've used the public defender systems myself in four counties with five different cases, driving after revocation or driving after suspension. And my experience with every public defender and applying Well, as far as applying, it was all similar except one, and I thought it was a good process except for the one. In Ramsey County, I used a public defender in two different situations, and I got the public defender in one situation and not in another when everything was identical. So that was a little confusing. It was actually in that situation where I had to ended up spending some time in jail. If I would have had a public defender for that, that would not have happened. But the whole court system needs an overview anyway, and our judicial system needs an overview anyway, irregardless of my behavior. But in my situation, I did have a 25-page brief ready for the public defender, and one of them I thought served me very, very well. As well as they could under the circumstances, but the other four I didn't think did that at all. But I would agree with what the public defender has said here in the comments of Representative Hillstrom. I thought they were accurate in relationship to my experience and what has taken place. Why I didn't get that public defender in that situation, I don't know.
Okay. All right. But thank you, Mr. Kinley. Representative Cornish has a question.
Mr. Chair, the testifier is wondering what you do for a living, how much you make a year, and what's your job history?
Right now, I am unemployed. I was 25 years in financial planning. I was a good financial planner. I did not make much income because I think I told people the honest truth, and people sometimes want to be sold things, and I would just say, here's your options, here's how it works. And so I wasn't making a whole lot of money, but I went through a divorce, and when the court system told me and took away my kids because I was teaching them inappropriate religious ideas and I couldn't force them into Bible studies for safety reasons and I couldn't defend myself, it was just thrown into a court order, so there's no findings of fact, no conclusions of law. I had to scramble. You don't get a public defender when your kids are taken away from you in civil cases. And all my money and resources went into that. And finally, I did sell my practice, but there wasn't much value there. And right now, I'm just living on fumes. So, and everything I have is going away. And so I'm spending some time trying to educate the legislators and representatives of what's happening in our court system and how it affects and people out there, and there needs to be some additional accountability. But anyway, that's a long answer.
Thank you, Mr. Kinley. Representative Smith, hearing no further discussion, the chair lays over House File 988 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or further action at a later time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Withers, do we have this room reserved for this evening?
Yes, 4:30.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'd ask you to, we have this room, I think, from 4:30 reserved until midnight. I'd like you to just simply recess and to the call or to the call of the chair, and we'll send out a notice precisely what time.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Smith. Members of the Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee will recess until 4:30 p.m. here in Room 10 of the State Office Building to continue today's agenda.
Or the call of the chair.
Or at the call of the chair.
Very good.